Okay, apologies about the delay, but apparently I've just been volunteered to do the chairing, but I was unaware I was supposed to be chairing, but I'm chairing another session tomorrow. So I'd like to introduce Dr. Ross Isles. So Ross is a senior research fellow in insurance work in the Insurance Work and Health Group at Monash University, which is a new group that's established. He has a physiotherapy degree and a PhD from La Trobe University and a graduate diploma in work disability prevention studies from the University of Sherbrooke with an E. And that's in Canada, for those who don't know where Sherbrooke is. Great return to work program there, by the way. Prior to joining the Institute of Work and Health Group, he taught physiotherapy and research skills to university students for over 10 years. Ross's particular research interests focus on methods of identifying individuals at risk of prolonged work disability, and this has led to projects in New South Wales and Queensland related to the development and implementation of methods to enable early and appropriate intervention. His approach to research is focused on developing a partnership, not only to understand the problems to be solved, but also identify solutions that fit best with the demands of all the stakeholders involved. So if we can just give Ross a warm welcome, and apologies for starting you a bit late. Thank you.
We'll manage. Hopefully this works. All right. So, I'm presenting today on a review we did of looking at transition between systems of support. This was a project EML engaged ISCA. So Karen Monk, who's in the audience, and Simon Bailey helped with the review. So I'll just give you a quick summary of what the presentation is going to be about. A little bit of context about sort of some of the reasons behind doing the review, what we were looking for, then what we found, and there's been, I guess, progress since the review. So a little bit about what we've learnt since then. So what we do know is that income support for people who are unable to work is a complicated system of systems. We're here at a conference where there are multiple updates from different systems in different states, and there are some common themes going on across the jurisdictions, but we have this complex system of systems. And we know that some recent, well, they're not recent changes in legislation, but some of the impacts are going to really hit home soon, that a large number of people will be required to actually move from one system of support into some other system of support. In late this year and early next year. So as part of a project we've been doing in the Insurance Work and Health Group is to actually try and map out the different systems of support that are available for people who are unable to work. And this particular project is only looking to examine 10 systems. So there are a number of systems here that are actually out of scope. But this is effectively the summary that we've come up with. Most people start off working, and when you're unable to work, there's usually a period of sick leave that would be your first source of income support. But if you're injured in the course of your work duties, then you've got access to workers' compensation. And depending on which state you're in, that might be a short-tail system or a long-tail system. So we define short-tail as anything less than 5 years, whereas long-tail, does tend to extend further in terms of continually paying benefits for a longer period. There's a special system for our Defence Force members, so the DVA system. And then also if you're injured on the roads, there are other systems involved, some that involve statutory benefits or lump sum. And what we're trying to... And underlying all of that, too, is that people might actually have some life insurance as part of their... they might have an income protection policy or a total and permanent disablement policy that they could actually draw income from depending on the nature of their injury and the circumstances that around what they have set up. Then there's also the opportunity in certain circumstances that you might actually be able to withdraw from your super. Okay, and particularly, unfortunately, if it's a terminal condition, you can actually access your super early. There's usually a waiting period involved. But there are circumstances where you can draw income from your super. Then also, then underneath all of that is what the support provided by Centrelink. So there's temporary sickness allowance, but or new start, or youth allowance, depending on your age. And then there's also that qualification process to get into the DSP, a disability support pension. Under all of that is whether someone might have their own personal resources they could draw on. And this diagram aims to give an indication of what sort of systems you might be able to qualify for and what sort of waiting periods might be involved. So, for example, if you're in an MVA lump sum period, so if you've been injured on the roads in a state where it's lump sum settlement, usually that takes a significant amount of time for that payment to arrive. So there's a long period where you need to derive income from another source. And we were approaching this question from the EML's perspective. So EML is a workers' compensation insurer. And so these are the possible directions that people could go in towards the end of a short-tail workers' compensation system. They could actually derive some income from an income protection policy. They could, depending on the nature of their injury whether they have the policy, go into dip into life insurance, a TPD policy. They could end up down at New Start. They might actually qualify for a disability support pension, but there's a significant waiting period in terms of the processing to actually get to qualify for a disability support pension. So you're probably going to end up on New Start to begin with before you can qualify for a disability support pension. And then there's also that option that you might actually be drawing on your own savings. So it's kind of complicated. And it's actually really complicated for people who know and research in this area to work out what's going on, let alone people who are at their best capacity to deal with some of that complexity. Of course, we know this is our intended, you know, that's our sort of our best case scenario, that towards the end of a scheme you might actually be able to get back to work. But what we were looking for, we aim to do a worldwide scan looking for models that would actually support transitions into different systems of support, because each of those systems have different rules of qualifications, different methods of payment. Usually they have their own systems of assessment. So having your independent medical assessment as part of workers' compensation, if you want to qualify for DSP, you've got to go through that process again. They're rarely multi-purpose assessments. And so we aim to actually identify models that were focused on proactively supporting, engaging and connecting individuals with options up to transition. So what was out there that actually proactively helped people get ready for that transition? And then models that actually manage that transition that are seamless and positive. So what models actually work really, really well from the worker's perspective? In this case, or the person's perspective. And models that provide post-transition support and follow-up. So once you've actually moved into that new system, what further supports are available? And then the aim was really to describe the features of those models, really to inform what the future might look like to deal with those legislative changes. So what we did, we looked through published and grey literature and we found a significant number of sources that with potential relevance, and we invited input from worldwide networks, so we've got multiple countries represented around the world, and we actually did this. This review was conducted basically late 2016. So, what we found? Lots of people said, "Wow, what a challenging topic," and everyone said, "Oh, that's really, really important." Not many people are actually able to point us to significant resources that would help us answer those particular review aims. So everyone acknowledged that it was a tough question and it was a really important one, but sort of said, good luck, let us know the results. There was a little bit of confusion, particularly with our international networks, that actually this question, it didn't make sense to them, that there was that requirement to move out of a system in the manner that we were talking about, that there was needed to be some sort of shift that you actually had to prepare people for, and it just didn't translate well. And so even when that didn't translate in the first time we actually asked people the question, we went back and asked again, and we asked the same question a different way. Same result. Wow. Good luck. So what that means is the actual evidence in this area we found is really scarce. So there's not a huge amount of evidence out there. And what we're aiming to do with this report and spreading the word is to actually guide discussion around the requirements of the services in this area. So we're not able to give strong answers in terms of outcomes and evaluations of how people fared after these processes. But we can start the discussion and be talking about what these services might need to look like. So in terms of the proactive supports in the lead-up to transition, so that first aim of the review, we didn't actually find any examples that describe models of preparing injured workers for such a transition. The majority of the evidence that we did locate was really focused around return to work and really trying to re-engage individuals in the return to work process. So we've drawn what we can from this literature, but you can see it's not quite exactly what we're looking for, because the people that we're talking about, if they've reached the end of their scheme, of the scheme that they're involved in, all attempts to actually re-engage and return them to work have either been tried or failed. And so that's where the majority of the evidence lies, and that's where if we were pointed to any evidence, it was around that, how do you re-engage people into that return to work. One thing that does come out of that literature is that supports need to extend beyond basic services. You can't just help someone prepare a resume and expect a good outcome for these people. There needs to be a detailed review of that individual's education, employment and skills from past experience. We know that motivation to return to work is helpful in return to work. So if you want to help someone re-engage either with work or even with their community, then you need to tap into what they've done so far. You need to have an idea of what floats their boat and then use that to actually guide what you might be doing. But that probably doesn't surprise anyone sitting in this room, I wouldn't have thought. So a seamless and positive transition. It's a bit of a theme coming through. No evidence was located. It really could describe the impact on outcomes for injured workers. So we really didn't have any strong evidence that could guide our approach. There are case-by-case approaches out there. They do exist. There is a general acknowledgement of that people do need support at that towards the end of the claim, and the efforts are far from seamless. So an example of that is that, for example, counselling services might be available to someone who's been given a decision on their claim. This is in a jurisdiction in Canada. But that's it. There's no preparation for what the next steps might be. It's just, well, here's counselling services and hope that that's going to be enough. And we know that cases that have reached this point, particularly in a workers' compensation scheme, they need a lot of help. I mean, you need a multidisciplinary team approach to working with these people. So a case-by-case approach or just giving people a list of resources is not going to be enough to help. And that's there, they're sort of the nature of the majority of the approaches. I do have some good examples later, so I just wanted to save them to the end, so at least there was some happiness. And it seems like if there's a single project manager who is actually going to coordinate those services is a likely approach that's going to be helpful in this situation. Post-transition support and sustainability. So we didn't have any information around health, quality of life or financial outcomes, basically after that transition. There are a number of community-based services that are identified that can connect workers to the local community and provide support post-transition. So there are services out there. They just don't talk to each other. And typically from a scheme like a workers' compensation to some of those services, the links are tenuous at best. And there's not a lot of communication between systems. And and that's what I was saying, evidence is not located that actually sort of clearly describes this is how you help that person plug in and re-engage with their community. And it turns out that services in that pre-transition phase, well, it makes sense that they would actually be applicable in that post-transition support as well. Bit of a challenge in terms of who's going to pay for that, because when they're pre-transition, they're still part of one system, but when they're post-transition, they're a part of a new system. So there are some things that need to be worked out. So features of the model. So we didn't actually find models that we could actually readily plug into the Australian context. But the idea is that these services should centre on individualised programs. They need to be flexible. We know these people have their own complex story as to why they're in this situation to begin with. And it's actually an example I'll talk about later. It's actually really important to maintain that management of their medical condition as part of the service is important. So it's not just about, okay, you're going to go off to work now. That they've got an ongoing medical condition that needs to be considered in as part of that transition. And the success is likely to hinge on the quality and skills of the people involved. And it was talked about a little bit before in terms of that people working with long-tail claims, they've got a real challenge to deal with, that it's quite a complicated situation. Well, this is exactly the same thing. So you need quality people to apply a service that's likely to have any impact. And there is also that emphasis on personal support in order to empower individuals. It's not really surprising in terms of the people at the end of a workers' compensation system, for example, are likely to be disempowered by the whole process. So any transition where you're actually asking them to adapt to a new set of rules, a new living situation, they're going to need some help to get control of that. Whew. So hopefully you're not too depressed, if I can work my machinery here. Okay. So here are some example services that we did come across. So there's the Speaker School, the New Direction Speaker School in Canada, which is actually run by an Ontario Injured Workers Network group. And this is a free program to learn how to speak publicly, gain confidence and leadership skills, and basically promote peer support and mutual aid for affected individuals. So it's an example of a program that seems to provide some of the skills that might be useful for these people at the end of their scheme. So the key features is you could certainly say it's individualised. People learn how to craft speeches and deliver or advocate for issues that are important to them themselves. And that's the mechanism that's used to actually, I guess, take the focus away from the workers' compensation system or the injury that's happened to them. Let's use an issue that's important to you and actually develop some of those skills. It's a peer-developed network, so it's connected. And because it's community-based, it's actually connected with volunteer programs. And the model has actually been adapted to different locations within Canada, so it's not just in Ontario anymore. It's quality of the people in the service, so it's probably not that surprising that this program was established by a highly motivated work-injured individual. So one of those people who was injured suffered an amputation at work and was just flabbergasted by the impression that people thought he would never work as a builder again just because he'd lost half an arm. And he's turned that into that motivation to continue to work and help into establishing this group. And it's empowering in terms of it's open to any injured worker or anyone in a socio-economically challenged position. So that's an example of a service you could actually see as potentially helping people to deal with that transition to whatever that next step might be. From the UK, there was an expert patients program which provide group-based support to help manage their long-term condition, delivered by people who either have the condition themselves or have experience with the condition. So perhaps it's a family member who's had that condition or whatever it might be. And the aim there being to develop communication skills, manage emotions and daily activities, and plan for the future. So key features, again, it's individualised. And it offers a toolkit of techniques to improve quality of life, and to learn to use the healthcare system. So there's an aspect of this is how you actually use the system for that particular condition. And also about understanding the importance of exercise, healthy eating, sleep, dealing with anger and depression, delivered by people who really understand what's going on. And it considers the condition, because clearly the management of that condition is actually part of the support that that is received. And the quality of people, expert patients are defined as people living with a long-term health condition who are able to take more control over their health by understanding and managing their own condition. And that sounds like exactly the kind of person you would actually want helping people through that transition phase. And it's empowering in terms of that everyone has the opportunity to become one of those expert patients and go back through the process and actually give back to that particular service. My final example is a local example, Reconnect, in South Australia, provided by Return to Work South Australia. That actually aims to help people transition from the Return to Work scheme funded services to other services. Advisors work in the service and aim to decrease the stress and anxiety of injured workers. So, if I go through the features again, it's flexible, it's individualised. So, face-to-face is available if it's needed. It's not needed in most cases, but it can actually be adapted. They can determine the support level of support needed for each worker, and it's available up to 12 months after cessation of benefits have ceased. Access to networks. I'm going to talk about the quality of people and quality of service. There are two advisors in this process, or at least there were when we did our review. One advisor had 20-plus years in education and training. And advisor two had linkages in the community with mental health services, both with extensive networks of supports and services that have been used over time. And the benefit of the quality of people and service there is they were actually able to conduct a lot of the assessments themselves. So they could actually go through that process of, okay, so tell me about your work history. Didn't have to outsource it to another place. Didn't have to give someone a list of services and get them to choose which one. So there are examples. Is it a direct fit that can be applied en masse? Well, probably not. Certainly not in the format that we encountered it when we did our review. But it certainly speaks to the quality of the people that you have involved. So the key messages. There are opportunities to prepare injured workers for transition points. So there is time to do that. And there are services that exist that can aim to develop some key skills and support and engage with community groups. We just don't have the models ready to go to apply. So it's not quite clear how to best handle that transition. Seems like a team approach is required, and you have a single trusted point of contact for the injured worker. It's not that different to what we know from long-term work injury anyway. But we don't know what this appropriate transition would look like. And it's likely that need to be quality. A token service is not going to help in this area. So, what we've learned since. So we know that workers, I'm being a bit harsh here, it's actually closer to 4,000 injured workers will cease pretty much on Christmas. Their average age is a little bit over 50. And their average length of away from work is actually, average is 12 years. So you've got 4,000 people been off work for 10 plus years that don't have a huge amount of time until retirement. So it's a really challenging situation for how can you prepare people for what's coming up when this whole system structure is really difficult to understand. And they're probably least able to comprehend or deal with the challenges that are required to potentially go from the workers' compensation to something like Newstart. And if they've got a partner who's working, their eligibility for Newstart might not actually be that crash hot anyway. And if they are going to apply for a disability support pension, there's a whole lot of time that they'll need to wait without support to get that happening. Plus, most likely, they're going to have to go through a whole another lot of assessments. And we know those assessments are damaging to people in terms of independent medical exams. They're stressful. And you have to prove your disability, which is never really a great mindset. And so what that means is for a lot of these people, it really might come down to that personal resources. The thing is, we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen because we don't know a lot about flow between those different systems. So in the Insurance Work and Health Group, we're actually in the throes of mapping those systems of support with the idea of really trying to put together a stock and flow map of when people come into a system, where have they come from and where do they go to? And it's not surprisingly, there are some holes in the information that we've got. But as part of this project, we're actually having interviews with key figures in different systems. And there's obviously a high level of knowledge of what goes in within each individual system, but very little knowledge of what happens outside of those systems. So where do people go when they exit? They don't know. Where do people come from? We don't really know that either across a number of the systems. And when people do know what happens in other systems, it's usually because they have happened to have worked there. Now, we were talking to people who are, you know, fairly high up in management type roles, so most likely there are people on the ground in other roles that would have different perspectives. But there isn't good visibility in terms of data where people are coming from and data where people are going to a lot of the time. So just an example of an upstream intervention. So MS Australia Employment Support Service is designed to address the needs of individuals with multiple sclerosis who are having difficulty maintaining employment. So multiple sclerosis is commonly a relapsing, remitting condition. So there are periods where people struggle they have an increase in their symptoms, so they might not be able to stay at work. Fatigue is a key health issue with MS. And so the ESS, Employment Support System, aims to actually support people with MS, providing specific condition related advice and understanding to help liaise and keep that person in employment or find an employment that's suitable that matches their symptoms. And there's a very simple financial case that's been put forward in terms of retirement actually ends up costing $30,000 per year. That's based on if this MS person with MS is working, you lose around about $10,000 paid in income tax. That is, the government would lose that in income tax. And then they'll have to pay another $20,000 thereabouts in a disability support pension. So retirement costs around $30,000 a year compared to that person with MS continuing to work. Whereas the provision of the service to support that employment support service costs around $7,000. So it's a pretty easy argument to make from a financial perspective that there are benefits in providing a service like this that's tailored to the MS condition. So, but beyond that, there are clearly significant benefits for that individual's health, the community, etc. So on a pure numbers basis, there's a strong argument, let alone everything else. And this is really taking that upstream view of if you can stay at work over there, then we're not going to have to pay the money over here. So the understanding transition, so often limited knowledge of where people are coming from and going to between the various systems. We do have some limited information from superannuation TPD claims that around about 22% of those actually end up getting back to work. 75% of those are actually in a different type of work. So talking about that TPD pathway, that even that's a low proportion of people going through that pathway. The majority actually going to require some help to find work in another job. And some analysis of TAC data is that more than 60% of seriously injured TAC clients will receive income from at least two sources. So there's a requirement that people need to be able to shift from their systems of support in the first 4 years post-injury. So we're not just talking about this is unique to people who hit a workers' compensation system with a mandated end period, but having to go through different systems of support is actually really common. I'm nearly there. So it's time to start talking and preferably doing something about transition to different systems of support. So that was me talking for half an hour, but that we didn't find anything.
Are there any questions? I think we've got a small room that we don't need to use a microphone if you all speak loud. Sue, would you like to? Let's say who you are, where you're from, and the question. If you could stand up while you ask.
Sue Crawford from the Personal Injury Education Foundation.
Hi, Sue.
Ross, the three examples you gave, particularly the overseas examples, who funds?
So the speaker school is a community funded, so it's a free service, so it's funded by the community, and they were funded by actually the story was some of the funding had disappeared, and so they were originally a wide network that has then contracted based on the withdrawal of some of that funding, so it's community based funding. The expert patients program, the resource we found, I'm stretching my brain, but I can't recall the funding source for that particular program. I need to dive back into it again, but I'm happy to do that and get back to you if you like. So Return to, and the Reconnect is funded by Return to Work South Australia.
Cool. Yes.
Can I ask two questions? I'm not sure if it's for Ross or Karen, maybe.
If you just say where
you are. Oh, sorry, Janine from WorkCover. So my first question is, what has EML decided to do for these people following that research, if you're able to share any of that? And secondly, I'll be interested to know what happens to people ultimately. So, you know, 12 months down the track, have they managed to return to work or whatever? So that's my question. Not sure who's there.
I'll do the second bit.
And Catherine might be able to help me with the transition piece as well. I spent some time just the other day with the claims teams who are working with workers who will leave the scheme at the end of the year. All those claims have been located into a couple of teams. So the iCare have created a community transition service that workers are allowed access to. We don't refer directly, but we provide a booklet and a sort of work booklet, which is full of all sorts of information about what sort of how to contact SENS Women, a whole series of things, and we provide that to the worker, and we recommend that they contact the service. We're not actually sure about the uptake, and we're not sure whether it's particularly and some of the feedback has been good about that service. But the case managers were saying, so in the lead up to end of scheme, there's been a big push for these workers again to offer them a last round of rehab and try and get them to go back to work, to use the concept of end of scheme as a sort of the carrot of doing something about it. Not all that many workers have taken up the offer of extra rehab. And case managers were saying that there's a lot of drug and alcohol issues within that client group. So they're actually, a lot of them are actually quite unwell.
And a lot of their drug dependency is paid for by the scheme.
Yeah. Mm.
Like it's not, mm-hmm. it's not illegal drugs, it's drugs that we've
been
paid
sorry.
For.
Yeah. The whole time it's within the scheme. So I suppose that's what's available for the scheme participants at the moment. But I'm sure iCare will be evaluating the whole process of that community transition service.
Thank you.
But in terms of what happens, we are, Insurance Work and Health Group are trying to, chatting with Sarah about actually ways we can actually monitor what happens to these people. We've got a... It's not a great way to think of it, but an opportunity to really find out what's going on in that space. There is a study in Victorian injured workers that aims to find out what happens to workers beyond 130 weeks of compensation. So it's starting to gain a little bit of momentum to try and find out what happens, but kind of don't know.
Thanks.
Shane O'Day from WorkSafe Victoria. Can I say, great work. And an opportunity, if we've seen in other sessions, to join some of these up, because obviously you're aware of the VWAS study, which you just referred to. We also undertook a fairly extensive review of workers who finished their common law process. So again, they're 5, 6, 7 years in. Again, the numbers are almost identical in terms of TPD and those who return to work. Mm-hmm. But the challenge is actually getting those people to talk to us about recruiting them into these surveys to try and understand, you know, where they've gone.
Yeah.
So that was just a broad comment. But my question is, in terms of the work you're doing, is a lot of this work seems to have a lot of applicability very early in the life of the claim. I mean, 10, 12 years, people are unwell.
Too late.
We know in our population in Victoria, we've got 4,000 injured workers who have significant broken alcohol dependency. So, again, a big focus on trying to remove that barrier before we can go anywhere else.
Yeah.
So I'm more interested now about, so you've got this big population, it's a bit of one-off because of the legislative change, but are you embedding this as a standard way of helping injured workers transition off the scheme and they are going off it? 6 months or 2 years or 2.5 years?
I think we have to do better than this, than this example for workers exiting, of all different types of exits moving forward. Because this is now going to become business as usual, that people will Section 39 off the scheme. But there's a whole lot of other exits that happen, and we need to start these conversations and the networking a lot sooner than we have for this exercise.
So Ross, there seems to be a bit of enthusiasm that this is a good idea, but I'm a scheme regulator, and I want to know, why is it a good idea? Well, why should we be helping people transition out of the scheme? I mean, why is it because we stopped paying the dollars? Dollars don't matter. So why is it important?
Oh well, and that's the approach that could be taken, and
well, that, a more positive response. Why is it?
Because
why is the scheme regulator showing interest in this, in your view? And why is it important they do?
Well,
I'm happy to help answer that.
Okay, I'll talk about what the project that is underway that is actually about understanding what happens as people move between. Move between the systems. And I guess the short answer is that these people have to go somewhere. And they're people. They're not numbers. They're people that are least equipped to deal with the challenges that might happen. And the answer could be, as a scheme regulator, you've got a responsibility.
So there's a social responsibility. Yep. Shane, you were having...
Well, it's not just the social. There's a very clear economic value to the broader economy. It's very, very significant. There's strong evidence that supports that. There's also, with this work, again, shifting it further and further to, you know, very early in a journey, injured worker's journey. There's no reason why these types of services couldn't be engaged within days, if not weeks, they're claimed depending on the individual circumstances of the worker. So part of this is almost a bit of prototyping and piloting to see what works. And unfortunately, we can't undo the experience that many of these people have had, but we can actually put in place better ways and better systems to support people. So we don't have 4,000 drug and alcohol dependent workers in the other 5 or 10 years' time. So strong economic argument as well as a very strong social argument to do this.
In the project where we spoke to people about the relationship between the systems, the most common theme that came out of it was there are opportunities to be doing things earlier.
Yeah.
And, you know, be thinking upstream, and even when things don't go according to plan, that you can bring some of that information forward. You don't have to start again.
Okay, well, that's the bill to say wrap up. So can we all give